This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We're going to plunge into the fevered world of dark conspiracy. We'll find the men who hate greens, the fringe media voices who call us to commit suicide. We must arrest hundreds of thousands of scientists for their role in the global warming hoax. We'll find out who is behind the scheme to turn the 9/11 truth movement, almost overnight, into the global warming denial network. Forget about 9/11. Our icon of hatred is now global warming. It's the terror face. It's Al Gore. No, it's the kingpin. The spider at the center of the web is... Not so fast. To begin my journey into the bowels of conspiracy, I first had to travel to a dark warehouse on the wrong side of Okayama, Japan. The 30-ish balding James Corbett awaits me. He seems shy, but as you'll find out, with a keyboard and a screen, Corbett is a lion against the climate. Mysteriously, Corbett hands me a slip of paper with three names printed on it. My arduous journey has begun. The first name is... I'm sorry, I'll have to blank out his image on radio because of death threats. Even though he's a huge, famous wrestler, the ex-state governor. Now...
People are going to become very, very wealthy, pushing this concept of global warming down the throats of the whole country and, for that matter, the world, and that it truly is going to be used to make money, not necessarily clean up the environment. And I mean, it took me back because I am a believer in global warming. But he gave me this sheet of paper with these three names on it. And he says, if you don't believe me, he said, talk to these three. And this is conspiracy theory.
Actually, that's from a cable series called Conspiracy Theory under the doubtfully named True TV label. It used to be called Court TV. Jesse sends his investigators, accompanied by the usual crime TV soundtrack, da-da-da-dum, out to discover the truth about 9/11, elite conspiracies for world control, and just in time for the Copenhagen Climate Conference, a hatchet job called Global Warming. According to the program, Guide Ventura, quote, uncovers evidence that leads to one man thought to be behind the global warming conspiracy, unquote. And hold your breath, boys and girls, until you find out who that giant behind this current is. If the tacky crime narration sounds familiar, it's the sound of Tyler Derrick, also heard in Most Shocking, the reality series showing crime footage from around the world, plus Students Gone Wild 2, Senior Smackdown 3, Eyewitness to Disaster, Liquored Up Ladies, and who could forget, Horror on the Highways 2, and Busted in the Buff. I knew that voice sounded familiar. All my favorite TV shows.
Still ahead, Jesse Ventura gets closer to the sinister forces behind the global warming movement.
He can explain the entire agenda, the move towards world government, the takeover of resources by megacorporations and the shadowy families that control them.
They're also out to control the way we live, from the cars we drive to the food we eat. Those suspects remain at large.
So Ventura's team trots off to a secret island to interview a man kept in the dark, allegedly due to the death threats he's received as a climate scientist denier.
Well, because the climate issue got picked up as a vehicle for the new religion of environmentalism and controlling people's behavior. And so, of course, if you're opposing their religion, then it becomes even nastier.
You've received death threats. Your career has been stalled.
Tons of people adding comments to blogs identified the big bald head and voice as the Canadian climate scientist Tim Ball, a man who hasn't exactly denied himself the limelight. In fact, just a month before this conspiracy show aired, there is Tim Ball in full video being interviewed by James Corbett in Japan. So Ventura's secret cameo was all for show. The program is littered with secret facts available to anyone with a few seconds to spare on Google. It's a joke, right? Tim explains that the global conspiracy is out to push warming, which might be good for us, except we are cooling. Yep, that's what he says. Let's listen to a little Tim here, and then we'll get more from Mr. Ball in our next big name, a bigger fish in the game of diverting your attention.
So if global warming isn't man-made, why are they telling us it is?
Because they're using it as a vehicle for political control, control every aspect of people's lives, the number of children you could have, the number of people on the planet, where they can live, where they what they can drive, everything. If you can control carbon, you can control the planet.
The doctor says he was bullied, shunned, and worse.
Professor Ball, who does not hold a degree in climatology, despite all his wild claims to the contrary, and hasn't published a peer review paper in the field in the last decade or two, is disappearing from mainstream attention because he has been so thoroughly outed as heading supposed nonprofits receiving oil company money. Ventura's team goes on to every major climate denier. Professor Richard Lindzen gets an interview despite his known funding by energy companies and his love for the tobacco and asbestos lobby. On to British producer of the great global warming swindle and, of course, Lord Monckton. Who else? I guess they didn't have time for Fred Singer in a half-hour program, or is he passé? The whole thing devolves into bathos with nothing from the real science community and no defense for the accused. The only contact with the evil one, whose name I can't say yet, is a shot allegedly from outside his Beijing residence.
There's the list. Here it is with these three people. Go out and prove it wrong.
The three names on the paper come from Noel Shepard, the associate editor of Newsbusters and Planet Gore, more denial sites. Shepard believes his Russian sources who tell him global cooling is on the way. Sure. But Professor Ball is welcome on the radio show of our next suspect, the second name on the list. That is...
Big Brother. Mainstream media. Government cover-ups. You want answers? Well, so does he. He's Alex Jones.
Alex Jones was born in 1974. He's a talk show host and video maker out of Austin, Texas. Jones goes out on radio through Genesis Communications Network, GCN, owned by multimillionaire gold seller Ted Anderson. They are now an ABC affiliate. That's right, Disney, with about 60 stations, including shortwave. But Alex Jones caught on to multimedia very early. His radio broadcasts are among the most listened to on the Internet. And his rapid-fire mini-documentaries are big on YouTube and other sites. Jones encourages listeners, as I do, to copy his work and disseminate it to others. Alex Jones pictures himself at the center of a movement. It used to be the 9/11 truth movement, but that's changed. Jesse Ventura's episode on 9/11 was downplayed on the Jones site, prisonplanet.com, but the global warming show got top billing. Some regular visitors to the site complained, saying that Jones was covering 9/11 less and global warming more.
Your movement has been usurped by the very same financial interests you thought you were fighting against.
Talk about a movement being hijacked. How did 9/11 truth suddenly become anti-science? Think about it. Who is the demon combination that either let 9/11 happen or helped it happen? George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Now, both men are known to be oil industry types. George Bush owned an oil company in Texas backed by the Saudi royal family wealth, which went broke. Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, the world's largest oil company supplier. But now the 9/11 truthers are supposed to support the Saudis, the world's largest oil suppliers, and home to 19 of the terrorists? To bring out the oil company line that humans, and especially oil companies, of course, are not harming the atmosphere. Bush and Cheney were Republicans. Now 9/11 truth has been turned into an agent of the Republican machine. The Republicans, like Senator James Inhofe, are leading the charge in denying climate change. 9/11 truthers, look on either side of you. The oil companies are standing on the right, and the Republicans, well, they're further on the right. Your old enemies are your new friends. And Alex Jones has a big dish of credit for turning this movement away from its origins. Let's face it, he was huge in 9/11, but now internet searches and news articles about the 9/11 attacks are fading out. Every movement based on a historical date faces this problem. Time goes by, people's interests change. Now most folks are concerned about the economic crash that started in 2008 and is still unfolding into who knows what around us. It is time to move on. Diehard 9/11 truther Mike Rupert resigned from the movement to take up the more important threat of peak oil. Alex Jones, whose wife Violet tracks DVD sales so closely, knows that 9/11 videos are beginning to sell less. We'll see a bump next year on the 10th anniversary, but after that, it's just history. Just Google 9/11 Truth and then climate change and count what you get. Whether it's fair or not, 9/11 is fading over the horizon off the hit parade. The new thing is climate change, and it threatens the gas-guzzling way of life so beloved by many American patriots. If a person could only provide a little denial, they might get back to more sales. Bingo. Alex Jones becomes denier-in-chief.
You got power, but because you look so stupid and so silly, everybody just makes fun of you and calls you environmentalist wackos. No, you're not wackos. You are the pale horse death. You are savage. You have power. And you are murdering people in mass. Congratulations. You wanted to be evil? You are evil.
Jones has bragged he has oil money in his family, a couple of oil wells maybe, a cousin in the oil industry. Alex has always denied peak oil theory as well. Jones has a basic ideology that helped him make this change. You need to listen to a couple of hundred hours of the Alex Jones Show to really understand this man. I've recorded all that for the fascination and the horror. The key to Jones, and the kingpin I'll reveal in a few minutes, is one man. He lived in a well-guarded compound in Virginia before entering an even more well-guarded federal prison for fraud, and there lies a story long in the telling. Lyndon LaRouche Jr. is an old man now, if still living when you hear this. In the 60s, he was a communist Trotskyite. Somehow, that morphed into what many have called a cult. LaRouche ran many times unsuccessfully for President of the United States, often calling himself a Democrat, although rejected by that party. The best book about him, Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism, published by Doubleday and by Dennis King in 1989. I shall briefly read this paragraph from Wikipedia on Lyndon LaRouche. The British, led by the Jews, are in control of terrorism and drug networks, and it is the mission of LaRouche's NCLC to wipe them out. Daniel Pipes argues against Lerman that LaRouche's reference to the British really are to the British, though he agrees that an alleged British-Jewish alliance lies at the heart of LaRouche's conspiracism. Well, that ends the quote from Wiki, and I'm not going to handle that much further or cover that. I mean, LaRouche's complex connections with the Ku Klux Klan or known Nazi war criminals, too much for this spot. It's touching that LaRouche continued to see the Rothschilds in charge of the world, in a way they might have been justly accused at their European banking prime in the 1800s when they funded royalty. It's a worldview that rings slightly true to the truly uninformed. Later, as very Christian American wealth overwhelmed the world, LaRouche and his followers just sort of tacked them on to the Rothschilds' model. Somehow they think the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, who were very Baptist, were the same. Never mind all the new wealth since then, like Buffett and Gates, all the new billionaires created in America and abroad, they are magically part of the scheme for world control. Now we have mainland China as the largest holder of American treasury debt. We are asked to imagine the Rothschilds control all them as well. Oh, and by the way, the Rothschild named in the Ventura conspiracy thing, well, he's dead. He died in January 2009. You should have checked your facts there, Jesse.
Shame on you for bringing this to my attention. And I know this hurts you so, but I just had to let you know. Don't shoot the messenger.
Mr. LaRouche also had a long history as an anti-environmentalist. He arranged spying on one anti-nuclear group, the Clamshell Alliance, in New England. His forces ranged themselves against a ban on CFCs, and they included a scion of the DuPont family who helped fund them for years. There was a kidnapping of Louis Smith DuPont, or was it deprogramming from a cult? It's a lush tale. But LaRouche's vitriolic hatred of the Greens, especially Greenpeace, has passed on to his teenage listener Alex Jones. The switch came naturally to Alex and still fits within the simplistic worldview of an evil cabal of puppet masters at the top and no responsibility for the rest of us at the bottom. The idea of a complex, chaotic reality involving billions of humans in an ecosphere never occurs to these men. The hate goes on through Alex Jones.
Look, if humans are so bad, Suzuki, you little twit, you control freak, you fake intellectual, kill yourself. Stop saying kill African babies, punk. Man, you make me sick. Maury Strong, hey, go jump off a cliff, you little effeminate twerp. Be right back. Stay with us, Dr. Ball.
Alex Jones also appears regularly as a guest on the much more popular radio program Coast to Coast AM. He's on his best behavior then. You don't hear him ranting like this.
Nobody can stop them. They're having their way with America. They want our guns. And if you're not with them, cops and military, then you will declare that you're with the Republic now. And don't tell me that I'm a weirdo because I'm upset about this and I should only go get upset about my favorite football team winning or losing. Listen, I know what tyranny means. I know the bankers are putting poison in our food and water. I know the bankers have stolen $8.5 trillion. I know we're under War Powers Act. I know they're hurting us. I know they're carrying out New World Order. I know they staged those terror attacks. You know what it's like to gut up to this and go out every day and go past the peer pressure and come out day one and say, 9/11 was an inside job and lose most of the radio stations I was on? You know what it's like to go to sleep every night knowing you work for a bunch of psychotic killers and you bastards are probably going to end up killing me one day? You know what it's like knowing you've ruined my life? You know what it's like? I'm tired of your crap!
I think Jones just comes to represent the current anger developing around white males in the late American period of empire, a kind of foil that both arms and disarms public action. Meanwhile, Jones flogs his video, soap, literally soap, nuclear alert, keychains, expensive water filters, and gold, 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 and say, if you need a little keychain to tell you that a nuclear explosion has happened near you, well, better check your hearing and your other senses. Well, the more frightened you are, and there's always a reason to panic, according to Alex Jones, the more gold you will buy, and that helps Ted Anderson and the network. Here is Alex with his network sponsor, Ted, supposedly a guest on the show.
I want to bring Ted Anderson up for this segment, part of the next, and then TARP was coming up. We'll get to all your calls. I just had that caller on for 15 minutes because it was a lot of important questions. They're talking about, Ted, people need to get gold coins, and I just want to make it clear to the listeners that you have gold coins that you bought when gold was 50 bucks less than it is now.
Yeah, that's, well, I try to take advantage of everything I can, and when the prices get down there, I buy it up. Here's an example right here, and I've only got 30, and it's going to be a first-come-first-served thing. I've got Philharmonics. The Austrian Philharmonics. Right now, if I go into the marketplace and buy these from dealers, I pay $8.25. Right now, I can sell them to you guys for $800. I also have a bunch of $10 Liberties at $6.73. Frank coins at $1.98. You can't beat it.
Like all conspiracy theories, a small dash of truth is required. Sometimes, gasp, I agree with Alex Jones. Even Alex Jones makes it on RT, the Russian TV channel, which Vladimir Putin freely admits is a state propaganda agent.
And so why would they do that? I mean, why would they essentially make up global warming?
Well, we know why. We have the United Nations documents. We have the Club of Rome documents from 1991. A private group of banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, and others are financing this. Ken Lay of the Enron fame in the mid-90s with Al Gore, this is on congressional record, in testimony, came up with the plan of a new form of derivatives that we've seen in banking that's caused all the problems based on carbon credits. And so it allows a select group of banks and brokerage firms to start buying and selling carbon credits on the world market and to create a whole new Ponzi scheme.
In my judgment, the cap-and-trade system with phony carbon offsets and pollution permits given out to big companies for free, it's a recipe for financial abuse and climate disaster. Probably Goldman Sachs types are drooling at the possibility for billions in profits from trading carbon credits. It may come as a shock to Jones and his new disciple James Corbett that many, many Greens do not support this capitalist scheme. In fact, Corbett, since you presume to tell environmentalists that we have all been taken over, I wish you would just come back home here. Come back home and try the West Coast and meet some real environmentalists, the ones who try to understand the science and who don't know any of the Rothschilds.
My name is George Hunt. I'm speaking to you from a video studio in Boulder, Colorado. I have attended some of the meetings and caucuses leading to the unsaid Earth Summit. When I served as an official host at a key environment meeting in Denver, Colorado in 1987, I was surprised to see David Rockefeller, Edmund de Rothschild, Secretary of State Baker, then Secretary of the Treasury, Maurice Strong, Waste Company Chairman and EPA Administrator William Ruckelshaus, UN Secretary General in Geneva, McNeil, and various World Bank and IMF officials there. What were the rich elite and bankers doing at an environment congress?
Still, I was intrigued to find out from George Hunt's 1992 film, also found on PrisonPlanet.com, against the UN Environment Conference, that Rothschild knew and cared about global warming back in 1987. The wealthy banker proposed a kind of tax on corporate profits to form a conservation bank to save the poles and the planet. How evil is that? I wish more of today's bankers were so bad. Here's a bit more from George Hunt, a Colorado man who took up the hate of Maurice Strong, and appears, well, it's magic, in the Jesse Ventura climate hit piece.
The world order wants to create a new society out of the ashes of chaos. A collectivist fourth world complete with a collectivist religion, collectivist finance, and unchecked world national socialism. The world order will offer Gaia, Mother Earth, to the masses as the Big Brother image to worship in the fourth world. Maurice Strong has already set up a 140,000-acre project in Crestone, Colorado, to develop this Earth religion system. I hope I have given you enough information to expose the designs of the world order crowd. They hope to run the lives of people for generations to come. They are the same crowd who created a Hitler, arranged the assassination of Lincoln and Kennedy.
Enough. I have finally named him the man who secretly runs the universe. It's Webster Griffin Tarpley. Laugh if you will. Tarpley is the living link between the aging LaRouche and the younger fringe media, including Alex Jones. Alex has told us a few years back that he grew up listening to Lyndon LaRouche in his home for 12 or more hours each and every week. He practically teethed to the never-ending lectures about cynical domination by the British Jews. Let's hear the two compadres, Jones and Tarpley, recite the theory again on GCN. And I ask my Canadian listeners to withhold their laughter, if they can, until the end of the clip. Deep down in Texas, we find out how the Queen runs Canada.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday, December 5th, 2008. For the next 50, more than an hour, we're going to have Webster Tarpley in. But he was listening out in the green room when I was covering Canadian Prime Minister wins suspension of Parliament, and we just went live at PrisonPlanet.tv, so I'll recap that for the viewers out there. Canadian Prime Minister wins suspension of Parliament, and it says Governor General Michelle Jean, the representative of the Queen Elizabeth, Canada's head of state, agreed to Harper's request to shut down Parliament. But this is Imperium here, because she is the head of state, and Canadians and Australians and others in the 20-plus Commonwealth nations always say, oh, well, that's just figurative, that's just ceremonial, her as the head of state. No. If you read the charters of these Commonwealths, it is the parliaments that are ceremonial, and it is the Queen's governorship, or through her governors, that is actually the power. So there it is in Reuters, and every time I mention these reports, people just don't believe me. And Webster Tarpley's written books on the British Imperium, written many articles on it and its form of government.
Under the Canadian and indeed British Commonwealth system, the Queen is the head of state of all of these places, and it's about 70 countries. It's a huge group. And in the case of Canada and Australia, we have these royal governors general. And the royal governor general is the guy who's just done this guy, Governor General Michel Jean. So he's the personal representative of the Queen. And you can see that he has more power than the Parliament and the Prime Minister, meaning that we had this agitation in Canada in the 1960s and 70s, saying that the Constitution had to be repatriated, right? They wanted to bring the Constitution home to Canada, and it turns out that was not done. I would say for people who have trouble with this concept, there are two examples. You can see that the Queen actually runs the show. One is in the Canadian NAFTA debate, in other words, to get the North American Free Trade Agreement passed, the Queen named new senators to the Canadian Senate to stack it, right, to pack it, to make sure that there was a
majority.
That's
right. They're supposedly going to be elected, but as soon as they didn't go the way she wanted, she came in.
She packed it.
Yeah.
Right. Because, see, what the Queen represents, the Queen is not, she's not somebody like Stalin, but she doesn't have all power, but she represents the oligarchy as a whole. In other words, she's the spokesperson. She's the doge, if you like, or the dogaressa.
But she does have Stalin-esque. She just doesn't want to use the power, because then that reveals that these parliaments are really ceremonial.
All right, for our American listeners, the evil Governor General is not he, it's she. Michelle Jean is a Haitian-born Canadian woman. The Canadian Constitution was repatriated by an act of the Canadian Parliament on December 2, 1981, decades ago. Boink, wrong again. Oh, yeah, and the Queen did not and does not choose any senators who have never been elected in Canada. Senators, when an opening becomes available, are chosen by the Prime Minister of the elected government. Completely misinformed nonsense from two American bobbleheads, and these are the guys you are supposed to believe on global warming science. Most laughable is the idea that the Queen runs Canada, its bureaucracies, and the Parliament is merely decorative. Rolling in the aisles, comic reporting from the twin LaRouches on GCN. Canada salutes your comic genius. Tarpley was a spokesperson and press agent for Lyndon LaRouche and the organization for years. He held various positions, including host of an in-house TV program, finally branching out more on his own in 1996. Now Webster Tarpley also has a radio program on GCN where he lashes out at the Zionists and compares President Obama to Hitler and worse. The program is called World Crisis Radio, and believe me, it's always in a crisis when you listen to Webster Tarpley.
And the envelope, please.
And why do I name Webster Tarpley as the grandmaster of it all? Because it makes as much sense as Jesse Ventura's ultimate target of Maurice Strong. Maurice has been a whipping boy of LaRouche, Alex Jones, and Webster Tarpley for years. He's practically a nobody on the environmental scene these days. He's old. He's living in China. Ventura is buddies with Alex Jones, and the whole thing just passes on by osmosis. A good opportunity for a fake reality cable series.
Hello, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 29th of November 2009. Indeed, there is an agenda at work where financial oligarchical interests are consolidating their power in unaccountable international institutions in the name of fighting this man-made climate change scare. And just as the clouds seem the darkest and the forces arrayed against us seem the strongest, we have been handed the keys to the gate, so to speak, in an effort to combat their spin and propaganda. And that is the ClimateGate scandal.
Meanwhile, over in Japan, hoping to get past his paycheck-to-paycheck living teaching English, James Corbett launches ClimateGate TV. It's pretty slick, as a gathering place for every anti-global warming video he can find. Corbett produces his own podcast and would-be radio show called The Corbett Report. He's even interviewed Alex Jones. It's a pity, though. So-called ClimateGate will disappear like a wisp of media froth as the world marches on. Corbett's defining moment has been waived by the world's scientists, governments, and media as, well, nothing much at all, really. James, you were doing much better as a 9/11 guy. I liked your video on repressive Japanese demands of ID cards for foreigners. But the video headline you have now, A Really Inconvenient Truth, No Atmospheric CO2 Rise in 150 Years... it's laughably wrong. The original article outlines that the fraction of CO2 going into the atmosphere has not changed. If we produce 100 million tons of CO2, about 43% of it, 43 million tons, say, goes and stays into the sky while the rest is soaked up by the sea and the soil. If we produce 200 million tons, then 43% of that, about 86 million tons, stays in the atmosphere. That doesn't mean the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere hasn't gone up. We can prove that CO2 has gone up. It goes up every year. It's either a beginner mistake or the usual desperation to grab at any straw, no matter how wrong. Take it down, James. It's an embarrassment. Of course, once you believe the Queen runs the world, there's little shame left. It isn't the environmental movement that has been taken over, James. It's the 9/11 truth movement that's been turned into an oily Republican machine that denies good science. And that's too bad. There are a lot of good people who have deep questions about 9/11, and I'm one of them. But we know that the science is not lying about climate change. Our senses aren't lying to us, James. Everybody loves a good conspiracy theory, even a bad one, until reality blows up in your face. Then it's time to deal with the real world, which isn't that simple. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download all our past programs from our website, ecoshock.org. Free MP3s. I'm sorry. You had to hear all this. in. There's lots more good stuff to come.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you an eco-sinner? Will nature take revenge on us? Crafty thinker Fred Pierce wrestles with such questions and shares the results in his many books, articles, and interviews. From the United Kingdom, Fred, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi, well, to start with, both India and Mexico, where population has doubled well within my lifetime, but, you know, you say our consumption is more of a threat than population growth. Why would you say that?
Well, that's the evidence of the last couple of decades. World population is not in percentage terms growing as fast as it was. Women are having much smaller children. And the big push now to put pressure on the planet to increase the use of resources really now is consumption patterns, particularly consumption patterns in the West, but to some extent now in countries like China, the fast industrializing countries. But I think it's not to say that population isn't still an issue, but we really have to look to our own consumption before beginning to blame eco threats on rising population in poor countries.
Well, when we talk about consumption, you've done a book called Confessions of an Eco-Sinner: Travels to Find Out Where My Stuff Comes From. And what sorts of things did you discover on that adventure?
Well, wow, a lot. I went to find out where the cotton in my shirt comes from, the gold in my wedding ring comes from, the coffee that I drink comes from, where my waste goes to, where the stuff that I send for recycling ends up. A lot of it seems to go to China, which was interesting. Where my computer mouse comes from. I discovered this amazing factory in central China, which I guess more of us touch the products of that factory than any other place in the world. Two-thirds of all the world's computer mice are manufactured in that one place. So, you know, we're all touching the stuff coming out of that factory on a regular basis. So I was looking at kind of the globalization patterns, if you like, around the world, how we're all now consuming products, whether it's food or electronic goods or other stuff, from a global marketplace. We are just much more global than we used to be. And I guess the central purpose of the book was to, if you like, reconnect with where my stuff comes from. I think, you know, a generation or so ago, people tended to know where their food, their things that they bought in the store came from. But we don't now because they come from so far away. So I wanted to find out who produced my stuff, who grew my food, by what routes did it reach me, and just to kind of reconnect. And I think if we're going to be, if those of us that want to be, if you like, responsible consumers, the first thing we need is a little bit of information about where our stuff comes from. And that was my journey. It was a personal journey, but I hope that it would provide pointers, at any rate, to where everybody's stuff comes from.
Yes, it does seem like most of our guilty pleasures also come from abroad, things like coffee and chocolate. Do we need to quit these things, or is there a better way to handle that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, some environmentalists say to me, you should be against all this consumption. And, well, maybe, but if you go and visit, I mean, look, I'll give you one project of the proof quite controversial, really, especially among environmentalists in Europe. Quite a lot of the green beans that we eat here come from farmers in Africa, particularly from Kenya. And a lot of environmentalists say, look, these are fresh produce. They're put on a plane. Look at the carbon footprint. Look at the air miles responsible for bringing those beans to us in Europe. We really shouldn't be eating those. And I would guess that you have similar products in the U.S. coming out of Mexico and other places, air freighted in quite long distances, big carbon footprints. Well, I see the point of what those people say, but I wanted to go and see the farmers who grow those beans. And it turned out that they weren't working in sort of large greenhouses or working for large landowners. They were mostly small farmers, smallholders with just a couple of acres, growing beans to put onto the truck that came around every day to pick them up, and the truck took them to the airport, and they were, you know, they were flying to Britain in no time. So my question really for the environmentalists was, look, Do you want to damage these guys' livelihoods? These farmers had a better livelihood because they were exporting to us than they'd had all their lives. You know, I met farmers who said, well, look, you know, life's not great. I don't even have a motorbike, but I have a push bike. I've been able to concrete over the floor in my house so that it doesn't flood in the rains. I can buy dresses for my wife. You know, I've got a TV now. One of the guys had a, you know, had a soccer cap that shows that he'd supported an English soccer team. Stuff like that. You know, they were now part of a global marketplace and they were reaping the benefits. So my argument to the environmentalists back home was, well, do you want to cut off these guys' lifeline to the rest of the world? Do you want to condemn them to the much more serious poverty that they had before? And I think we need to think about those questions before we suddenly say we're not going to buy those green beans. So I said to the environmentalists, look, yes, okay, you should be cutting your carbon footprint. We should all be doing that. That's agreed. But why don't you do it in a way that will inconvenience you and not these Kenyan farmers? Why don't you walk to the store, take the bus to the store, rather than driving your car? That'll cut your carbon footprint. It might be a bit inconvenient for you, but isn't that a better thing to do than cutting your carbon footprint by refusing to buy those beans? So there's, you know, there are ethical dilemmas here. That's my judge. I buy more of those beans now than I used to. That's my judgment. I've not in the book said everybody should take that view. I can quite understand other people who would take a different view. But look, you know, there are ethical issues out there. And my book is kind of teasing out those issues, putting them before people and say, well, you know, come on, guys, think about this. What's your position? Are you more worried about climate change, or would you like to back those African farmers and help them maintain a better life?
Well, you tend to be willing to take some flack and some heat just by getting people to really think through these sorts of arguments when it comes to the environment, would you say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people just say I'm plain wrong. A lot of environmentalists that I've spoken to in Europe, not just in the UK, but in Germany and elsewhere, said, no, that's really, you can't do that. You've got to be against this. We've really got to cut that carbon footprint. And as I say, I understand that, but many of them haven't thought through the issue in the way that I presented it to them. So, yeah, I think we've got to have these debates. I'm not saying somebody's right or I'm wrong or I'm right. I'm just saying let's have these debates. If we're serious about being ethical consumers, we have to think about human lives as much as we have to think about our own carbon footprint. And we have to be very careful, I think, as rich Western consumers to try and reduce our environmental imprint in ways that damage other people's lives. If we're going to do it, and we should be doing it, we've got to make sure that we don't, if you like, use our power in the marketplace to damage other people by boycotting certain products. Maybe we've got to take the hit. Maybe life's got to be worse for us.
Right. Well, you know, on another issue, Lester Brown has written about countries that export water through their food production, and Canada does that with our massive wheat exports. How does that fit into the global environmental picture?
It's a fascinating, this whole business of virtual water, they call it, you know, the amount of water embodied in products sold around the world. Absolutely fascinating. We in Europe are major importers of virtual water. We import lots of thirsty crops to keep us going, whereas the three major exporters are the U.S., Canada, and Australia. Now, in many ways, that's a good thing. You can, you know, countries that would otherwise be starving are not starving as a result of this trade. The Middle East certainly lost the ability to feed itself a couple of decades ago, really. Many countries in the Middle East, Egypt and Jordan and others are desperately dependent on imports of food, imports of thirsty crops to keep them going. So, but this is an issue. What happens if the world starts to run short of water, or more countries begin to run short of water? Then that trade will begin to literally dry up. Food prices are going to start rising. There will be more food shortages. Many analysts, for instance, talking about the big food price spike in 2008, say, I mean, there are a lot of explanations for why that happened. Some people said it had to do with growing biofuels in the US. Some people said it was speculation. But an awful lot of evidence has accumulated that the big reason that happened was a drought in Australia. That Australia, as I said, was one of the big exporters of grain crops, big exporters of virtual water. When Australia ran out of water because of a major drought, which hit its big agricultural region, it stopped those exports. And that was the key reason that pushed up grain prices in particular around the world. So that's just a little signal that we may be coming up against limits. And that trade in virtual water, which keeps a lot of people fed, is also creating a new vulnerability, and a vulnerability which is likely to get worse with climate change. We're going to find unexpected droughts in a lot of places around the world, just as Australia have found in the last few years, and parts of the US are finding certainly now, and out in the West. And they are creating new vulnerabilities. Now, probably the rich countries will be able to pay the extra price to buy the grain. We're probably not going to be the people who go hungry. But countries, relatively poor countries, that have become reliant on importing basic foodstuffs could be in quite serious trouble. Countries that a generation or so ago were famine countries but now aren't could again be in trouble. I remember back in the 1960s when India was a basket case. There were huge famines still there. Millions died. Now India feeds itself. But is that going to carry on? India is very dependent on overpumping its underground water reserves. I spent some time in India looking at this. Massive overpumping of those water reserves. The water tables are going down and down and down. India is kind of living on borrowed time as regards its water. So, you know, there's more than a billion people in India. What happens when India can't feed itself suddenly? China's already reaching that position. These are major threats. And what's, I think, happening with the trade in thirsty food crops is that we're kind of globalizing local water shortages. So the local water shortage through the medium of the global food industry, global food market, is kind of being globalized. So a local water shortage becomes a global food crisis really very easily. And those are, I think, pointers to what's going to happen in the next few decades.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is British author and journalist Fred Pearce. In your earlier book, The Last Generation, you suggested, quote, man-made global warming is on the verge of unleashing unstoppable planetary forces. That's out of the range of our everyday experience. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the dangers of tipping points in the climate system. We talk a lot about we talk a lot about how climate change may play out and droughts and rising sea levels and so on. Mostly when scientists talk about this, they show you smooth lines on the graph, you know, trends extending out 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years. And that's up, if you like, the best estimate, the ones, you know, scientists can agree about. But if you talk to scientists, in their laboratories, in their canteens, or, you know, wherever, or sometimes in the conference rooms these days, they're talking more about sudden change, abrupt changes to climate, tipping points, if you like, where we might switch off the Asian monsoon rain system, for instance. We might shut down ocean circulation systems with big effects on climate in Europe and North America and perhaps elsewhere. Tipping points in the ice systems. We've seen how Arctic ice has disappeared much faster in the last 4 or 5 years. Is that a tipping point? Are we reaching the point where Arctic ice is going to kind of disappear virtually every summer? We'll still have it in the winter, I guess, but during the summer it could virtually disappear. What about those huge ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica, which could raise sea levels not like we get now, a few millimeters, centimeters over a few decades, but meters? You know, we could see 5 or 6 meter rise in sea levels, which would flood huge areas of of the most populous parts of the planet. What is the risk of that if there were a sort of tipping point in the Greenland ice cap? And some scientists, glaciologists, are beginning to talk about these things, how we could get runaway change. What about all that methane locked in the permafrost in northern Canada and especially in Siberia? That's a huge natural reserve of greenhouse gas. And if the permafrost melts, well, the permafrost is melting. We can see it happening every year. We can see the damage being done. And methane is starting to bubble up out of the permafrost. Now, what happens if that starts happening on a larger scale, pumping more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere? What happens if, as some climate models predict, by the middle of this century, the Amazon rainforest, it just becomes too hot and too dry for the Amazon rainforest to survive, and it kind of disappears in a sort of mass of fires and dried out soils. Huge amount of carbon also, therefore, in the Amazon rainforest. What happens if that goes into the atmosphere? All these things can accelerate climate change, make it happen faster and much more abruptly. And what's scary, I think, is the research that's been done into the history of past climate, natural climate change over the planet over the last thousands, millions of years, which increasingly suggests that climate on planet Earth doesn't change gradually. It usually changes suddenly. Things kind of reach a kind of tipping point and they run away. We run into or out of ice ages, that kind of thing. Ice sheets collapse, sea levels rise and fall very abruptly. There are points that they're now discovering by analyzing trapped air bubbles inside ice cores that suggest that parts of the North Atlantic region warmed by something like 10 degrees Celsius within a couple of years, about 10,000 years ago. A fantastic pace of change. It's like changing from summer to winter, but as a permanent effect. We're talking about average temperatures here. Absolutely huge jump in the space, probably of 1 year. And if sea level is rising by a number of meters over a century, very fast change, much faster than anything we're seeing now. So that's not to predict that something specific is going to happen. But what it suggests is that nature does things by jumps. It doesn't do things by smooth lines on a graph. And if we're interfering, as we are, with, if you like, the planetary thermostat, putting carbon dioxide, that really important greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere in huge quantities, if we're fiddling with the planetary thermostat, we can expect that we're going to reproduce those kinds of sudden changes. And that's what the climate scientists, or some of them, many of them, are saying, is it's not going to be a smooth line on the graph like it says in the IPCC reports. It could be much more sudden, much more abrupt, and of course, much more disruptive for human civilization.
Right. We really don't have a plan for such an event.
No. I mean, let me put it this way. I think the climate skeptics have a point when they say we know less than we think about climate change. I don't quite believe those lines on the graphs either. Where I think the climate skeptics are really wrong is in assuming or jumping to the conclusion from that, well, maybe we don't need to worry about climate change. Well, possibly we don't, but I think it looks more likely that we have to worry a great deal more. So when we say, well, the scientists are really not very certain about how climate change is going to go, are they? That's correct. Is that a cause for us to be, say, okay, well, maybe it doesn't matter. You know, there's a lot of climate change around, so what? Let's forget about it. Get on with our lives. I think that's a really wrong conclusion to draw. I think we actually have to worry more about climate change, not less.
Well, that leads into the January 4th, 2010 report by the Royal Society. It's called The Response to the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee Inquiry into the Regulation of Geoengineering. Now, the Society says there's a crucial difference between investigating geoengineering and deployment of such techniques, but I'm having a hard time thinking of a technology humans know about but don't deploy. What are the possibilities that one country or even one rogue billionaire might change the atmosphere or the oceans?
Well, there are a few possibilities. I mean, we know, for instance, we just have to look at what nature does. We know that if a really big volcanic eruption, for instance, and they happen from time to time, puts into the atmosphere very large amounts of sulfate aerosols, just which have the effect of, well, shading the planet. I mean, it's just like a kind of shroud over the whole planet. And we know that these can cool down the planet. We know Mount Pinatubo a couple of decades ago in the Philippines cooled the planet about half a degree or something like that for a couple of years. So maybe we could do that on a global scale, kind of send planes up or shoot rockets into the upper atmosphere and release very large amounts of sulfate aerosols or maybe something else to deflect solar radiation. Some people, including the Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen, who helped discover the ozone layer, suggest that we could be doing something like that. There are various other ways that we could reflect solar radiation back into space and maybe try and cool ourselves down a little bit that way. There are ways of absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. If we have a problem with putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, well, the best way of doing it, of solving that problem, would be to put less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But if we really need to do something in a hurry, maybe we need to find a way of sucking it out of the atmosphere. There are potential technical fixes for that. There are also natural fixes, like planting many more forests so that they will absorb the carbon dioxide. Some people talk about fertilizing the oceans so that the oceans can absorb more carbon dioxide than they already do. They take quite a lot now, but maybe we could encourage the oceans to take more. Maybe you could put some things in space, like parasols in space, to divert the sun's rays. So there are a number of possibilities here. There are a number of questions about those. Would they work? Would we be able to carry on doing them? Because they're not mostly one-off fixes. You have to carry on and on and on doing it forever, and probably doing more and more of it all the time. So it would be a huge enterprise to do those things. And the other question is, well, who would do it? Who would be in charge of this? Maybe we need a kind of world government to decide what to do. I don't think you could have just a billionaire sort of deciding to, if he was going to be in charge of the temperature of the planet. That doesn't sound like a very good idea to me. So there are really big issues about how you would manage an enterprise like that. But I think we need to look into this. We, as I say, if I'm talking about tipping points, really scary things happening really quite quickly, then we need to find out what we could do if things got really bad. That's not a prediction that they're going to get really bad, but they could. Maybe it's a good idea for scientists to explore these options. And that's certainly what the people at the Royal Society in London were thinking about. They're not saying, well, this would be the best way of solving the climate change problem. But I think they are saying, look, you know, maybe we need to have something up our sleeve in case we need it in a hurry.
Well, on another topic close to many, the economy continues to slide in both Britain and the United States. Isn't it possible we'll just be paralyzed with whatever we already have and maybe we won't get these new green projects at all?
Well, yeah, look, I've given up trying to predict what's going to happen to the economy. That's a mugger's game. Look, even if we stuck where we are, even if the global economy didn't grow at all, we are still putting into the atmosphere billions of tons of carbon every year. Even at that level, that carbon is accumulating fast in the atmosphere. Things are going to get worse. In other words, staying as we are, doing what we are with the world economy just the size it is now or even a bit smaller, doesn't mean that climate change doesn't get worse. Climate change will get worse. Those gases stick around in the atmosphere. Not all of them, but a lot of them stick around in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So it's accumulating. It's building up all the time. That's why President Obama and other world leaders have said we need to cut our emissions, especially from the rich world, by 80% by 2050. They're saying we've got to do that just to stabilize the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, just to stabilize temperatures. We've virtually got to stop the emissions. So if you like, sticking where we are and doing what we are now and not having a growing economy doesn't solve the problem. It stops it getting worse as fast as it otherwise will, but it's still getting worse quite fast.
Well, you're sometimes known as controversial, if not contrarian. What are you working on next?
Well, I've been looking at the whole population issue. That's what we started with, looking at consumption versus population patterns. And I really want us to address where we are on consumption. It's I detect that increasing numbers of people are talking about population as if that's the big issue, and unless we solve the problem of world's growing population, we can't solve anything else. Well, I have two answers to that. First of all, I think the issue is not population so much as consumption. But secondly, if you look at the numbers, it looks to me, and this is the good news, it looks to me like by mid-century, the world's population will very likely be falling. It's amazing if you look at the numbers. Women today have fewer than half as many children as their mothers have. They have about, if you take a global average, it's about 2.6 children per woman. And the replacement level, allowing for girls that don't grow up and have children who die young or whatever, is about 2.3. So if we can get, we've come down from between 5 and 6 to 2.6. We're really getting quite close to that 2.3, which would be the long-term stable population level. And if you look at more and more countries, they're not stopping at 2.3 or 2.1 or 2. They're going right on down. Most of Europe, the average woman in most of Europe has 1.6 about children. It's a little higher in the UK, and it's about still about 2, 2.1 in the US. But if you go to China, okay, they have a one-child policy. That distorts things, but not just in China. If you whole across the whole of Eastern Asia, Japan, Korea, Singapore, Thailand, many countries, even Iran, amazingly enough, many Asian countries where there aren't draconian population control policies, people are choosing not to have children. They're having fewer than two children per woman. And before long, that is going to result in populations starting to fall, and starting to fall quite fast. Already in Europe, we only maintain our populations by bringing in workers from elsewhere in the world. Migration is maintaining our population in Europe now. So as I say, by mid-century, I think we're going to have a falling world population. I think properly managed, that's a good thing. It will reduce our impact on the environment. There will be issues like aging to deal with and migration patterns that are going to arise in order to kind of maintain economies in fast-falling population areas. But I'm optimistic in that sense. I think we've been through the big population surge. If you like, we've diffused the population bomb.
Right. Well, Fred, do you have a website or blog where people can find out more about you?
Do you know, I mean, right now, not a lot. I'm in the process of setting one up. If you Google me, you'll find me all over the place.
Right.
And that's probably the best thing to do. I'll tell you this. I promised my publisher that I'll have a website up by the time the population book is published in a couple of months. So it'll be up there, but it's not there yet. Right. I won't promise what's not there, but Google me. You'll find me.
We've been talking with Fred Pierce. He's the author of many books, Confessions of an Eco-Sinner, The Last Generation, and a lot more. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. And Fred, I want to thank you for sharing your time with us.
It's a pleasure.
You have been listening to Radio EcoShock, broadcast on 21 stations live by satellite and cable, by podcast and downloads. Visit our website, ecoshock.org. We'll go out with that fine tune by Gordy Sampson from the album Sunburn. Don't shoot the messenger.
Everybody likes you because you got that special way. You shimmer and you shine, and you drop the ball sometimes, but that's a small price to pay. I don't mean to speak in riddles, I'm just trying to make you see. And so true are all my words, it's the gospel of the church, and they will sting you like a bee. Shame on you for bringing this to my attention. And I know this hurts you so, but I just had to let you know that I'm